from the Duck South Studios in Morgan City, Mississippi.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
I want to punch you in the face so bad right now.
This is the On the X podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I didn't get a harumph out of that guy.
Get the governor a harumph.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
Today's episode is brought to you by Advantage Multi from Bayer. Advantage Multi is veterinarians' number one choice in the prevention of heartworms, fleas, roundworms, hookworms, and whipworms. Treats and controls sarcoptic mange. Make sure your dog is protected by using Advantage Multi.
I said what I said and I'll stand by it to the death.
Ladies and gentlemen, can I please have your attention?
And now, here are your hosts, J. Paul Jackson.
You just love to hear yourself talk, don't you? Even when you're not saying anything.
Rocky LaFleur.
Yo, Adrian! Adrian!
Houston Kennedy.
Please, Houston, we have a problem.
And Josh Webb.
Coons! Well, raccoon's trying to get on our back porch. Mama just chased him off with a broom.
Welcome to the Bear Advantage Multi On the X podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com. As always, today we're brought to you by Hardcore Brands and Hardcore Decoys. Hardcore makes the most innovative and durable hunting products out there on the market. They're definitely made for the hardcore hunter, and they know it's not easy being hardcore. Man, I'm so excited to be here today as part of this podcast. It's Sunday afternoon as we record it because we've got the whole gang with us today. I'm your host, J. Paul Jackson, but I'm also joined by all three of our co-hosts, the illustrious Rocky LaFleur. You there, Rocky?
I'm here.
And we've got our resident fat boy, Houston Kennedy, back with us this week. How you doing, brother?
I'm good. I brought my lunch.
And, of course, Josh Webb.
I'm here, buddy. It's good to be here with everybody.
Man, let me tell you guys, I am so excited about having all of y'all here with me today. I mean, for all of us to be together, you know, Rocky's holding down the fort there in the Duck South Studios in Morgan City. And also from Mississippi today, I'm excited because we have a very, very special guest, probably the most all-around knowledgeable guy that I know when it comes to duck hunting. His motto is, it's always duck season somewhere, and he has literally hunted ducks on almost every continent. I'm pretty sure not Antarctica, but we're very, very fortunate to have with us today from GetDucks.com, Mr. Ramsey Russell. Ramsey, brother, thanks for joining us today for the podcast.
Very glad to be here. Glad to be here.
I tell you, when Rocky told me that you were coming in, I was really excited because we're right here on the beginning. Today was the opener of till season, and I know that right now you're participating with a group, a very fluid group, it appears, as it would be, because the birds are not necessarily totally predictable in researching blue-winged teal. But also, today we're recording on a pretty special date, 9/11. And before we get into waterfowling, Rocky, tell us, this is a special day for all of us in that we remember it. I don't think there's probably anybody on the podcast today or listening that can't tell us where they were. Where were you when you first started hearing the news on 9/11, 2001?
I was actually in school at Mississippi Valley State University in an advanced computer programming class. And I remember it coming across the screen that morning when it first happened. I had an 8 o'clock class that morning. And back then you didn't have videos to watch. There was no live feed or video or anything like that. But Yahoo had a news service back then, and I remember seeing it come across the Yahoo screen. And the first thought that came to my mind when it happened was, I mean, you knew how big the World Trade Center was, but the first thoughts that came to my mind, it was just an accident. And then I remember walking out of my second class that day at in Itabena, Mississippi, and somebody saying that another plane had hit, and I think one of the buildings had fallen by then, and, you know, everybody was just kind of in a panic mode at that point. But I remember watching it throughout the day. I was working on a farm in the afternoons after school and seeing as the news came in, and it was just, I think everybody kind of just stood around the TVs and just disbelief that day. What about you, Houston?
Well, it's crazy that you say that about a computer programming course, but I was in a computer programming course, but I was in high school. So I was probably 9th grade. And this sounds crazy, but my first thought was, did we plan this intentionally to go to war? And then, like, everything kept unfolding. And then when the second one went in to the Twin Towers, I thought, this is crazy. There's no doubt that it's terrorism. Because you always hear about conspiracy theories, and that was kind of my first thought. But then I remember my teacher flashing up the picture of when the Secret Service agent whispered in George Bush's ear, and it was complete shock on his face.
Yeah, I think that same shock resonated, you know, with all of us that were adults. Now, Josh, you're the youngest one of the group. What were you doing that day? Do you remember?
I remember very clearly when the first one happened, y'all like this, I was in the principal's office. I was in the principal's office. I was in the 8th grade.
In the principal's office. I want to hear about that in a minute.
Yeah, okay. But let me defend myself. The principal was my mom, so I was in there instead of being in class. But, I was in there, and I was actually in the class I was supposed to be in was history class. And I walked across the hallway out of her office into the history class because at that point, all the teachers, everybody had it on the TV. And it, I don't know if it was just being so young, it didn't really make a lot of sense until the second one hit. And then, you know, then you kind of realize, you know, crap, this is real, very real. And you can't, it's really hard to, you know, as a, whatever it was, 13, 14-year-old kid, it was hard to wrap your head around it. But it was, I clearly remember where I was, and obviously now I've known how big that day is in our history. But at the time, it was just chaos, and I didn't really know how much it would affect me at that given time. And obviously, it's affected every American, you know, since that day. But yeah, that was a crazy time. I never will forget seeing that first video footage on Miss Kemp's TV. That was my teacher on that teacher's TV as soon as I walked back in the room. That was a crazy, crazy day.
Ramsey, where were you when 9/11 was happening?
I'll never forget it. I was sitting in a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service weekly staff meeting. And who knows what we were talking about. It wasn't very important, I'm sure. But one of the equipment operators walked in and said, and all he said was, turn on the TV. Y'all got to see this. And we turned it on and watched smoke coming out of the one building and were there when and watching when the second flight flew into the building. And it was very humbling. You know, everybody says it's the day the world stopped. It was a very humbling experience for me because I had a four-year-old, I had a two-year-old, and had a wife. You know, expecting in a few months when it just all came crashing down. And it's amazing to me. It's not just how we Americans felt. It's people all over the world. I've got clients from Australia. I've got clients from Malta. I've got clients in Europe. And anytime I've met with them, that and Katrina, those two subjects always come up. But especially 9/11, how profound the effect was, just far-reaching. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's funny, everybody knows exactly where they were sitting and what was going on the day that happened. And I've got my daughter was born a few months after that. She was born in January, and I just thought it was kind of revealing when I read something the other day that her generation is the first, she's a freshman in high school, and they're the first Americans to learn about this event, you know, as preceding their birth. And it's just, but, you know, I think about it all the time. It seems like it happened yesterday.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's one of those things that, you know, there are certain events in life that just become etched indelibly in your mind, and there's a mental picture that usually accompanies those. And some of those memories are etched even so strongly that there is a smell or an odor that when you think about them, not only can you see the mental picture, but you can actually remember the smell and remember the feel of the atmosphere of that day. You know, for me, some of those times are, you know, when I was, you know, in first grade, the first man to walk on the moon, sitting in my car in college, in an old Pontiac Grand Prix, listening over the radio as I heard about the first space shuttle exploding and the horror that that threw all of us in. And the day that the Twin Towers came down, when the initial report came out, I was waiting. It was a really cool September 11th, a very nice day, kind of like we have today. And I was waiting for Mr. Bill Pittman, a gentleman from Island, Tennessee, to come over and train dogs with me. I was listening to the radio outside off of my truck while I was working dogs in the yard when I heard about the first plane hitting. And in my mind, it was a Cessna, you know, 172 or something. I could not imagine a jetliner, a commercial airliner, hitting the Twin Towers. And we actually went into the house when we heard about the second one. And when we got to the field and heard that the towers, the first one had come down, not only can I see where I was at, I can remember the smell of the fresh cut hay where a farmer was cutting hay in the pasture beside the one that we were training in. And I think that there are certain events that, you know, shape our lives. That was definitely one of those events. And for like your kids and mine, like you mentioned, Ramsey, I mean, I've got a daughter that is 16, you know, it's 15 years ago today. She has no idea. She's learning about that stuff. But for those of us that lived it, we'll never forget it. And I hope everybody out there still remembers to honor those that died that day. So many innocent people. I know this morning I said a special prayer for their families, like I always do. And you know, I'll tell you, this is a pretty powerful day, I think, to just about all of us out there.
Well, I just thought of a story real quick that before we toss it over to Ramsey about Teal. Chelsea did a wedding for a girl last year whose sister actually worked in the Twin Towers. She was working in the Twin Towers that night. She worked for Showtime, and she worked till 3:30 that morning. Then her boss was like, hey, go home, take a shower, and then let's meet at the office at 6 a.m. in Brooklyn. Other than that, she was supposed to be in there. So every 9/11, Chelsea texts that mom and says, just want to let you know, thinking of y'all, because it still tears that mom up to this day, that her daughter was supposed to be there. But her boss said, let's call it quits at 4, go home, and then come back at 6. So that's pretty real, even for somebody that Chelsea done a wedding for.
You know what gets me is the years as they pass, they just seem, it just seems like yesterday we just had the 10-year anniversary, and now we're at the 15-year anniversary. Just, man, time passes by so fast, and it seems just like that major event in our history just happened yesterday. But anyway, we'll always remember 9/11, very important part of U.S. history. And, you know, I'm sure we could all really go off today about the way the NFL is treating players that want to honor 9/11 today. But we're going to get to a dog training subject.
Don't do it. Don't talk about the NFL.
Yeah, I'm not going to do it. We'll all go crazy. We've got a lot of stuff to cover with Ramsey. But first, we've got to get this question into J. Paul from a Duck South user.
All right, Rocky, shoot.
All right, the dog training question of the day, J. Paul. A guy is having trouble with his dog being gun-shy. How do you go about breaking that dog from being gun-shy? What would you do?
Wow. You just asked me the hardest question out there. And before I answer it, I want to remind everybody listening that The first segment of the On the X podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com, has been brought to you by Bear Animal Health, manufacturers of Advantage Multi. Now, Advantage Multi not only controls fleas, ticks, and a number of other intestinal parasites, it also in the Mississippi Valley is the only heartworm preventative that is 100% effective in the prevention of heartworm disease. And Rocky, I got to tell you, that question that you just asked me is probably the hardest that I ever get. First, let me say this. Gun shyness is something that is usually made. Most dogs are not born gun shy. Gun shyness is usually the result of one of three things. And it's important that I bring these out because if you've got a dog that has this issue, overcoming it is easier if you can identify the source. And here are the three. Some dogs are just really, really poorly socialized early on. So they are wary, skeptical, apprehensive, become anxious over all kinds of different things. And no matter what age you introduce them to gunfire, it spooks them. And if it's not done correctly, you know, then you get gun shyness. The second category of dogs comes out of a dog that is not introduced to gunfire early enough. He may be an extremely well-socialized animal, but, you know, and trainers even make this mistake all the time, but it's a huge amateur mistake. A lot of amateurs, you know, they go out and they're training their own dog. They work the dog in their yard, and they maybe even, you know, go to a sports field or golf course or someplace to, you know, have a buddy throw birds for them, you know, pasture, whatever. But they don't think about, just like we talked a couple of weeks ago in a podcast about not introducing the dog to feathers, they don't think about shooting around the dog. So the very first time that they shoot around the dog, they're right there beside the dog, and all of a sudden the dog flinches and bolts. Well, again, they've just created that problem because they waited too late to do it. And then the third way that dogs become gun shy is traumatic experience. You know, the dog, 4th of July, we talked about this one also. 4th of July, you know, dogs the house, and all of a sudden you're setting off fireworks. Or even worse, you know, maybe someone throws them into a dog's kennel with a dog where they're trapped in there. Just not the proper introduction to that kind of loud banging noise. And so the dog becomes fearful of it. So those are the three main causes. Correcting it. Number one, it too is a three-part process. Number one, it is something that takes time. It does not happen overnight. Number two, if you know which of the three it is, you know, let's say it's number two. Let's say that, you know, where you haven't shot around the dog and all of a sudden on opening day, guy takes his dog duck hunting, puts that dog in a pit. He's never shot over the dog. And the first group of ducks comes in and four guys unload their shotguns in a pit where we all know that sound resonates and the dog leaves for the truck. Okay. If you know the way it was caused, you can do things to correct it. In that scenario, not only do we want to be very slow, like I said, number one, but number two, we want to take that dog back to that place and gradually bring it in and, you know, start by shooting way off in the field. Bring the dog back to the pit. Let it know that that pit's a safe, safe place. Forget about hunting for the rest of the day. Have your buddy go out 100 yards away. You know, particularly if the dog likes birds, you know, have him throw the dog a few birds and have somebody way in the distance when you throw a bird, fire a shot, and gradually bring that dog in. The third thing is make it enjoyable. Make that dog start to understand that that noise, the gunshot, is something really, really good. Great things happen when guns are going off. You want to keep it really, really upbeat and make sure the dog knows that it's fun. So the three keys here. Number one, take your time doing it. Number two, if you can identify where it came from, go back to there and start gradually and move it in. Number three, keep it really, really upbeat for that dog. You want the dog, when it hears that gun going off, to be like Pavlov's dog when it heard the bell. You know, Pavlov would ring the bell, put out the food. Eventually, he could ring the bell, and the dog would start to salivate, expecting food. We want to use that same theory and get that dog excited through positive reinforcement about that gunshot, thinking, hey, something great is fixing to happen. And if you'll take it really, really slow, be very deliberate, starting at a far, far distance, and keep it upbeat, you can overcome it, but it is always a tough, tough thing. And, man, I really do appreciate the questions that I get every week, and I hope that I did a pretty good job giving you a starting place to overcome your dog's gun shyness.
This part of the broadcast is brought to you by TrainingWithJPaul.com. Now, Training with J. Paul was designed to help individuals that want to train their own retriever at home and solve problems that they face every day. And look, one of the things that Houston has created for us on Training with J. Paul since he designed this website is a discount code to use on the site. Just type in on the X at the coupon code. You can use it. You'll get a free month. And my favorite part of the website, and I talk about it every week, is AskJPaul.com. It's a part of Training with J. Paul. Just ask a question, type it in. J. Paul will reply back to you usually within 24 to 48 hours. Now, let's get to the meat of this podcast. Ramsey, I am glad that you are here, being that it is the opening of duck season with teal season opening up. And Ramsey was actually up dove hunting with me, guys, last weekend. And I didn't know about this until Ramsey was telling me, but Ramsey is about to make a trip, and I'm not going to go into details. I'm going to let Ramsey talk about it. But Ramsey, tell us about the trip you're about to make starting next week.
Hey, yeah, it's well, you know, I don't know why. I tell everybody, I get asked a lot, what's your favorite duck? And my favorite duck is the next one over the decoys. And that's a fact. That's the truth. But I don't know why.
I want to use
blue wing teal. Blue wing teal are like a kryptonite, and I don't understand it. I really don't. I've been fortunate to hunt a lot of different places and shoot a lot of different beautiful birds, and but these little brown blue wings this time of year are just my personal kryptonite. I love them, and you know, we talked earlier about 9/11, which was a milestone for humanity, and for me, the blue wing teal season in Mississippi is a milestone. It every year, the fall rolls around, and it's just like a reset button. Okay, here we go again. And I know you asked me about a trip, but I'm just going to tell you, here we are opening week of the new chapter in waterfowling this year. And my season started the same way that it ended last year in Mississippi, and that's with a whimper. Not a roar, but a whimper. And, you know, I showed up at camp here around Vicksburg. I showed up just, you know, take it in stride. I hadn't been here very much. I was gone through most of the first half of August. I didn't really scout too much out here. I knew we had some water. I knew we had some habitat. But I just figured, well, we'll have some blue wings or we won't. And I got here Friday night, and there were folks excited. Oh, we got blue wings. We've been seeing them here. We've been seeing them there. And the neighbors over there were talking about they had blue wings too. So we went out with all the optimism in the world, and I fired a single shot and killed the only duck. I fired the only shot in the whole bottom I could hear. And I don't know where those blue wings went. We went out this morning, though. The wind started blowing out of the north just a little bit, about 5 to 7 miles an hour north-northeast, which usually means real good things. And I'm going to say we saw about 10 flocks this morning and had one just as we had dropped our guard and we started talking about other things besides paying attention. We had a flock strafe the decoys, and we pulled ourselves together and knocked three of them down and shot a single that come in later, but that's it. My poor little old dog picked up four ducks this whole weekend. And but what we did see is we saw a lot of flock working high. We saw some in V formation. They weren't checking up at all. They were heading south, and which kind of brings me up to what the question was is if you'd asked me just a few years ago when I was hunting with you, J. Paul, I believe you and I met on a blue wingtail hunt and made a heck of a show at the time, and a heck of a hunt. And that was a heck of a year. That was a year or so after Katrina, and a lot of federal government had instituted programs to kind of short stop up here a little bit away from the Gulf Coast, to short stop ducks. They'd given landowner incentives to go and make shallow water habitat very productive to hold up these birds, because they didn't know what the birds were going to get into down in, maybe it wasn't Katrina, maybe it was that oil spill, I believe what it was, and they wanted to check them up here, and it worked. Boy, I mean, we had blue wings for days that particular year, and if you'd asked me back then, you know, I'd shrug and say, well, I know a lot about ducks, I guess, but I guess when the ducks fly down and hit the Gulf Coast, they just keep on going when they're ready. I think they just fly on across the Gulf and go down to parts of Mexico and Central America. And we've learned since that's not the case.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. We met, actually, it was September of 10, and we were in a till field that morning. First time we ever met. I was blown away that day with your knowledge about them. But I had forgotten that there was a program in place that year giving incentive. It was after the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, and there was a program that they had put together giving farmers incentives to produce shallow water areas just for the purpose of keeping the blue wings away from the oil spill, whether it was real or imagined. I'd forgotten that. And it worked that year, you know, obviously, was something that worked.
Wow, it worked.
And the bird stopped,
yeah.
And we killed the living heck out of them that year. But, you know, also one of the things that affects them is their migration. And you told us a whole lot about it that day and why they were able to do it thanks to that incentive program. You probably know more than anybody else that I know. Tell me about the migrational patterns of the blue-winged teals.
Well, yeah, if you had asked me back then, I'd have said I thought they just hit the Gulf Coast and went on across the Gulf, you know, just wherever they hit. And we found out that's not the case. We were actually down in Louisiana a few years ago chasing teal and bumped into some biologists there that were tracking radio collars. You know, they had some radio monitors on some of these blue wings, and you know, it's typical, should have been here yesterday, showed up, and the blue wings had moved on. It was kind of a slow hunt compared to what they'd been having, and we happened to bump into this biologist, and he says, oh, those birds are, we had a dozen birds in this area just a couple of days ago, and half of them are down in Mexico now, and a few of them held up around El Campo. They're sitting in El Campo. Well, what they've learned through this research is that the birds, Alabama and clear on across, you know, as they hit the Gulf and get down that Gulf habitat, that marsh, they stop, they feed, and then they all take a hard right turn, fly due west, south of I-10, and they stay in that coastal marsh and those rice field habitats, especially when they start getting into southwest Louisiana. And they're just gorging themselves. And they fly on down, and they say that somewhere around El Campo and Matagorda, somewhere in that part of Texas, that's where those birds start heading south again. So all the birds that are streaming through Mississippi, Alabama, North Louisiana, hitting down around Venice and that part, once they get down that coastal marsh, they dogleg down to around El Campo. And I've got to tell you, I was telling Rocky just the other day out in the dove field, he was asking me about some folks down that part of the world, and I told him, I said, you know, just about the time I think I have seen and experienced everything there is to you know, nothing can possibly surprise me anymore. I show up to a place like El Campo last year, and we were driving out through a big old rice field, and it was a ratoon crop, you know, where they harvest it, and it starts to come back up, and they hit the water just right, and it so perfectly coincides with the blue-winged teal migration coming through that part of the world, that it's a spectacle. I mean, it's an absolute spectacle. And we were driving out in a big four-seat Ranger that morning, and I was chatting to the driver, a young college kid, and he was talking about they put to bed, you know, 8,000 or 10,000 birds out in this field. And I'm just sitting there thinking to myself, most people throw out numbers. Yeah, there's 1,000 here, 100,000 there. And, you know, really, I mean, that's just a wild guess. I was thinking he probably wouldn't know 10,000 birds if they flew down his pockets, you know, and sure enough, We get to where we're going, we stop. My son steps out. He was been in the back seat. He says, "Did you see all those birds?" I said, "What birds?" He said, "My gosh, Dad, how could you miss it? There were just thousands of them flying." He said, "Look up." I looked up and kind of looked to the east where I could actually see some light. And it looked like Cordoba, Argentina, from peripheral vision to peripheral vision, left and right. And all up above me were just flocks and flocks upon flocks of blue wings coming through. And we happened to be yeah, go ahead.
Quick question for you. You had said that when the tail get to the Gulf, they turn an angle or they turn a 90 off. Do they turn east to west or they go west to east?
They go. I think they go. I think all the birds. I think most of the blue wings are coming through. I think most of them are coming through Central Flyway, and but I think our Mississippi Flyway birds, all of them are turning west. So I think once they get down around that Gulf Coastal Marsh and start hitting those habitats, and they hit that Gulf, I think a lot of these blue wings start veering straight west down around I-10 and all that rice country. It's rice and marsh, one or the other. And you think about it, there really hasn't been a major disturbance down in those marsh areas. You know, Katrina blows in or a big, heavy storm surge comes in, and it just decimates that habitat. The salt water gets in there and just really messes up a lot of that coastal habitat now, kills all the natural foods. And on the years they don't have the disturbances, let alone the stretch of years it's been since there was a major storm surge come into that Gulf, it's very, very productive. A lot of natural foods out in there that ducks just live on. And they get in there and just get fat. And I think a lot of the birds hold over. You know, I know certainly you see them in parts of Louisiana throughout the whole season. But the bulk of the migration heads west and somewhere around that El Campo area, That's when they start hopping down and spreading out through Mexico or wherever they're going. They've confirmed that with radio collars and things of that nature.
When you said El Campo earlier, where is that?
South of Houston. That area, the old Katy Prairie, they call it. And it doesn't produce near the rice that it used to. It's still some rice going on. There's a lot of water issues going on in that part of Texas. You know, one of the first hunts outside of my backyard I ever took, I was a very young man. I was about my son's age. I was in college and was co-oping down in South Texas. And as a little boy growing up in the Mississippi Delta, and I was telling one of my sons this just the other day, back in the 70s, you know, we'd sit out the end of the driveway, carpooling to school or whatnot. And I had never seen a snow goose on the ground. The only thing I knew a snow goose to be was a mile high flying over in the mornings. You look up and you see all those flocks of snow geese migrating to the south. But at that time, they were heading down to the Gulf Coast. And at that time, if you picked up Field & Stream, Outdoor Life, any of those major magazines, you know, Katy, Texas, that Katy Prairie was just booming in rice. It was booming in snow goose hunting. And so the first hunt I ever took outside of my home ground of Mississippi, I wanted to go snow goose hunting. And I went down to Katy, Texas. The limit was only 5 back then in the late 80s, early 90s. But we had a fantastic snow goose hunt. Of course, the expansion of agriculture up north here in Arkansas, Mississippi, parts of Missouri, a lot of those geese start to hang over now. But in the same transition, that same period of time, those fields in that area we were hunting around Houston, Texas, that Katy Prairie, a lot of it's been converted to residential and commercial real estate developments. And at the same time, the lower Colorado River Authority had their water rights and all the dispute going on with them. You know, there's not water available to irrigate as much rice as there used to be. But nonetheless, those birds are just imprinted on that area, whether it's a geographic funnel or whatever it is. That's where those birds are coming through. Invariably, that's where those birds are coming through. Our birds coming from Mississippi, maybe going somewhere down around Venice or Gaydon or somewhere along that area. But once they get to that Gulf Coast, they head west toward what remaining rice fields and marsh there is and head that way, head on towards into Mexico, wherever they're going to overwinter.
And Ramsey, talking about following them west, that is have you already started on your trip? Can you kind of explain?
No, no, I haven't. I just
that, that you're going
you know,
on. I didn't know when it started, but
no,
I,
it's coming, and, I, and it's touch and go right now. I got to tell you, we got and that's what I love about wild bird hunting. Anyway, there's no fence in the sky. You know, we're at the mercy of God and the weather on what these birds are going to do. And right now, they're I've been hearing reports since about mid-August of blue-winged teals showing up down in southwest Louisiana and in parts of Texas. And I was talking to an outdoor editor, and he kind of wanted to come down and tour Dixieland, his words, not mine, and just take a look at some stuff. And I sprung this idea. I said, well, you know what we ought to do? We got a 16-day window of opportunity during teal season. It's a magic time of year. It's just the whole genesis of it all. I said, we ought to start in Venice, Louisiana. Do a little blasting cast. We got a great outfitter down there with U.S. Hunt List. It's a beautiful part of the world. They usually got a bunch of teal that time of year. And then we'll head west with those teal. And so he couldn't come because he's elk hunting with his father. And I talked to a few riders, and you know, y'all know how it is. Some of these guys are married to the corporate clock. They can't dream of getting away a week, let alone more. And so the editor called me up and said, Randy, why don't you go and do it? And then you write the story. I said, I will. And I guarantee you, I'm signing me up. And once I didn't have a writer to contend with getting somewhere and back, I said, well, heck, I'm just going to do this thing right. So I was planning on leaving tomorrow, hunted this weekend in Mississippi, where it always starts. And then I'll pick up and drive down to Venice tomorrow, hunt for a couple of mornings, and transfer over to Lake Arthur. Southwest Louisiana. I've got some contacts around Gaydon. I work with a really nice outfitter down in Southwest Louisiana. I've got some friends from Blue Collar Decoys that have got some prime land down there. Hunt for a few days. That puts me into about next Friday or Saturday. And then I'm going to jump across the Texas line and hunt that Anahuac area. It's all that coastal marsh and some rice on the east side of Galveston Bay. Then I'll dogleg up around the Trinity River and head on back down towards the Gulf Coast on the other side of Galveston Bay around Matagorda and El Campo. Well, that's kind of touch and go now. What's the point in going if there aren't any teal? And, you know, I was very excited up until about Saturday morning and even this morning. I feel like any Mississippi hunters, I feel like tomorrow and the next day is going to be the time to be out there. I just really feel that tomorrow morning, we're going to have some birds. There were a lot of birds moving this morning. It was a good wind that I've seen really push some birds. As y'all may know, we're fairly active in social media. And, you know, different businesses, Facebook pages is different things to different companies. But ours, I've tried to make it very inclusive and try to make a sense of community. Because what I really want, rather than just advertising, who wants to be advertised to? What I've tried to do is engage people, get them involved, and I want them to post on my page. I want them to share their experiences, pictures of their kids and their hunting reports. And so it's very telling as a resource. And this weekend,
yeah,
there are blue wings. I talked to a guy this morning from central Illinois that mm-hmm. this morning in the blind saw the migration up in Illinois. He said multiple flocks of 20 and 30 flying. He said, and they were gone at daylight, but they were blue ones.
Yep. And let me tell you, Ramsey, I hate to interrupt you, but, you know, you were talking about being stalled out there and social media and stuff. This morning I got a picture from a friend of mine in St. Louis with a stringer of blue wings. And just then, while we were talking, I got a text from a guy in northern Arkansas, and they went out and hunted yesterday and killed a couple. And he said yesterday afternoon they thought about going back out and they started seeing pour in. And this morning he said there were 10 times as many teal, and they actually passed on them because they were still building in. And I just got an invitation to go hunt northern Arkansas tomorrow. So I think that the migration is probably just a little bit behind. You know, you talked about the fact that they, the kind of photo migrators that the were able to predict, I think you told me 5 years ago or 6 years ago when we first hunted together, one of the reasons that it's pretty easy to set blue wing till seasons is because mainly they are photo migrators. So we've got a pretty general idea that the agencies can use for setting the seasons, but also you told me they are influenced somewhat by climate, particularly a cold snap can really do a lot to make a move in a hurry, or if it's unseasonably hot, they'll just stay put up north for a while regardless of the length of the days. And we've got this cold snap. Now we've got reports that birds are coming through southern Illinois, Missouri, arriving obviously last night in northern Arkansas. And that's pretty good news because, you know, when you take a look at the duck count this year, according to the 2016 population survey, and Ramsey, I want to hear your thoughts on this. According to the 2016 survey, our blue-winged teal numbers are down from an all-time high last year of about 8.5 million. Down, I'm trying to pull it up here where I can see it. Blue wing last year in 2015 survey, 8.547 million birds. This year, still 34% above the long-term average, but down from last year, 22% to about 6.7 million birds. Ramsey, what do you attribute that 22% decline over the last 12 months to?
That's a loaded question. That's a loaded question. I got to be careful in public. I got to be careful. You just said a whole mouthful. And one of the most, and I'm not talking last year El Nino when you got this real weird weather. I'm talking normal weather conditions like this year, this time of year. One of the things that just I love about blue wings, and just imagine this. You know, when you think about mallards, you think about snow cover coming down. You think about all those birds kind of pushing ahead of the front, staying out of that frozen Arctic weather and coming on down to where there's open water and food resources. But blue-winged teal, I was hearing about those birds down in South Texas and South Louisiana in mid-August. They said they'd seen some since the 1st of August. And just 2 weeks ago, I knew some biologists that were banding up in Saskatchewan, and they were catching bunches of blue wings, and just about 10 or 11 days ago, the catch of adult males just dropped significantly. Boom. And I went up there and banded back in 2001, and we caught a pile of them. I think we banded nearly 8,000 ducks total, and 5,800 to 6,000 of them were blue wings. And we noticed the same thing, and it was explained to us from some of the more experienced trappers that that's what happened with those blue wings, that those adult males, the oldest of the males that had the biggest fat reserves and weren't attached to a brood they had to migrate with, they hit the bait first. And I can tell you that 89% at times of our initial trap catch was adult drake blue wings. And then it just dropped significantly, boom. Right there around the end of August, it just dropped down to a very fraction of what it had been. And 90% of our catch was adult females and then juvenile birds. They were the vanguard. And as we speak right now, you know, you're talking about birds in Arkansas. There's birds, I have not talked to anybody up in Canada recently, and in the last week or last 5 or 6 days. But as recently as 7 or 8 days ago, they were shooting them up in parts of Manitoba and Saskatchewan. So somewhere between here and the Dakotas, you know, the big bottle is. And I think I'd say about mid-continent, north side of mid-continent is where the big bubble of blue wings are. I think down on the south end, I think it's predominated by adult males. And it wouldn't surprise me if some of my outfitters were telling me that there were blue wings showing up in parts of Mexico. But it's very, very stretched. I mean, it's almost stretched across the entire continent's width is this blue wing migration. And that's what I like about it. I mean, you know, we duck hunters are optimistic anyway. You can't continue to be a duck hunter and not just have some unbridled optimism about tomorrow, the next cold front. And that's what I like about the magic of blue wing teal hunting. I mean, you know, I've sat out for an hour in still weather. And we really, in my part of Mississippi, we really don't catch a we don't get a lot of blue wings. If we're going to kill a bunch of blue wings, it's going to be the opener, and then it's going to be the front.
Hey, Randy,
the fronts blow through. Go ahead.
I don't mean to interrupt you again, but you know, talking about blue wings being the early migrators and or the earliest of them and everything, is it on the population side of it? Is it that there has been a decline, in your opinion, or is it just that they're maybe harder to count because they take off and leave so early?
I think that blue wings are early migrators. They're not excluded. A lot of your blue wings, some of your green wings, your shovelers, some of your pintail, you got a lot of birds that migrate on photo period, and then you got birds like Canada geese and mallards that predominantly migrate on hard freeze when the food resources. They're a very hardy bird. They hang up north longer. In terms of a population decline, I had a statistics professor in college, and he said there's lies, there's damned lies, and there's statistics. And there's always, you know, when you look at statistics and you look at these estimates, you've got to remain cognizant that at best they're very educated guesses. But you know, the way they're sampling certain areas, and you know, I'm always wondering what kind of variables there would be in the sampling survey. You know, was this area in a drought and the birds displaced? You know what I'm saying? Or did they move elsewhere? And I'll give you just a very good example, a very, very good example about sampling error, because it's an imperfect system. At the end of the day, you can't possibly count every single bird, so you go and sample different areas, you come up with this big statistic, and you make these forecasts. Last year in the Atlantic Flyway, the Atlantic branch limit went from 2 to 1 with a 30-day season, and my captains up there and the people I've talked to and a lot of the guides had been to the big flyaway meetings, and man, they were singing the blues. They were scared to death because they said we heard from the biologists, went to the meetings, and they're not going to make a rash decision and close the Atlantic branch season in 1 year. They're not going to go from shooting 2 in 60 days to shooting none. So this year they're going to give us one branch in 30 days. Next year, which is this coming year, they're going to repeat. And from what we understand, talking to biologists, they're going to shut it down because there's not enough Atlantic branch to shoot. Well, dead gum. I mean, that's kind of unnerving. Well, guess what? The limit is this year, 60 days, 2 branch. Why? Because somehow or another, in their sampling errors, in their sampling of the historic area that they fly over and compute, make their computations, they somehow missed 120,000 breeding birds. Well, that's significant.
So what you're saying, man, is that's a perfect segue to the observation that I wanted to give here. If I understand you correctly, then what you're telling me, Ramsey, in answer to my question is, you know, maybe there's a decline, and maybe, because this is based on May pond counts, and the May pond count area is not always the exact same. It varies from year to year. There is that they fly over. You know, we could be 22% down, or we could be just missing some of them because they just didn't fly over the right areas. Is that right?
It could be a sampling error. But here's what I will say is that it probably is fewer. Not so many fewer that we need to be concerned. You know, a million here, a million there, what's the big, but I'm saying it's probably fewer. And you
okay.
know, I'll give you another example. Just talking about sampling estimates is when the biologists that are flying and looking down and counting the number of ducks in a given area. It's really not important. It's really not. You know, say you and I were two different biologists, Jay Paul, and you're going to fly over one day and I'm going to fly over the next, and you said there's 10,000 and I say there's 15,000. The number's really not important. It's the statistic because statistics have shown that you and I may count differently, but all things equal, our percent change plus or minus. So the next time you flew over, you said there's 20,000. Well, I would probably say the same thing. As long as it's the same person counting and doing a lot of this surveying, the statistic they take into account, I mean, the numbers may vary, what you see and what I see in terms of actual numbers, but the statistic is more accurate, that plus or minus percent. Do I agree that
gotcha.
There's X percent fewer blue wings? Not necessarily, but there could be. You know,
gotcha.
It's too much to say. I mean, at the end of the day, what's coming over my decoys? You know,
well,
at the end of the day, that's what matters.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, it's just like my guy that I just heard from in Arkansas. If you'd ask him yesterday, you know, are there any blue wings in Arkansas, northern Arkansas, he'd say, no, man, they hadn't made it here yet. But if he hadn't went out at all yesterday and had only gone out this morning and seen what he saw, if he'd have said, you know, the same question, hey, man, are there blue wings in Arkansas? Oh, man, we are loaded up, you know. But – you know, you got to take a look at the big picture. I think that's why this year when they changed the way that they set the framework, it's not that big a deal. A lot of people are going, well, man, they can't do it without the May pond counts. Well, as you just pointed out, I think you gave the best example ever. They're not an exact science. And, you know, we probably don't – 22% down, it appears, on the blue wing. Well, yeah, that may be true, but just like with the Brant, don't panic yet. Let's see – what the big picture says when we look at all the other factors. And I want to, you know, tell you, I appreciate you because that's a hard one to answer. And there are a lot of people that would be reticent to say that, hey, you know, the counts aren't always accurate, but it's just a fact. It's a human thing. And I appreciate your honest answer. And Houston, I know you've got a question for Ramsey that you've really been wanting to ask. And why don't I let you go ahead here?
All right. Quick question, Ramsey. I know that blue wing teal are what they call photo migrators, but how come they're earlier or they don't migrate with other ducks? I mean, sometimes you'll see, you know, mallards coming down and you'll have other ducks with them too. Why are blue wing teal just blue wing teal?
I don't know, and I don't always see that. I mean, I have hunted areas during blue wing season. You got to be very careful not to shoot shovelers. And I have seen in the past, this time of year, you do get, this time of year, right now, you do get some pintail flux. And I had this talk with a magazine editor. We were talking about last year, El Nino, which could kiss my hiney. I don't care if I ever hear those two words again, because it was a very, very tough duck season nationwide last year. And because the birds didn't migrate. I mean, the divers didn't come down into the Great Lakes until late December, really, to speak of. And those birds just they're on their own time and schedule. They migrate differently. I don't know why those birds come down in mass so much earlier than other birds do. I really don't know that, but they do. Maybe because they've got a longer ways to go. I really don't know, but that is their life cycle. They come down in mass this time of year. And not to say you won't see a few scattered birds held up or stopped over for whatever reason come down, but they do. But I have seen a lot of migration. One thing, that's what I was saying, is I was talking to that editor last year about El Nino, and I got a phone call, and it was a terrible duck season. Look, I'm 50 years old this year, and it was the worst duck season in the South I could ever remember, and it was off everywhere but the Pacific Flyway, a few northern states, and just a few little places. It was just bad off. I think everybody would agree with me when I said that. But I got a phone call right there around Christmas. An outfitter we work with, SWC Sportsman's Lodge in Venice, gave me a call and said, hey, why don't you bring the boys while they're out for school, why don't y'all come down and duck hunt down here in Venice? I said, really? He said, oh, yeah. I said, have y'all got any ducks? He said, Lord, yeah, son, this is Venice. We got ducks. And I made a few phone calls to some friends of mine, and they're like, yeah, we got ducks. You know, we ain't got quite the pin. We hadn't got the pintail we usually do. We ain't got the redheads. They hadn't showed up yet. We ain't got quite the canvas backs. But, yeah, we're covered with ducks. So we go down there between Christmas and New Year, and it was the three best days of hunting in the Mississippi Flyway I've had. Limit, limit, limit. We were there when the redheads showed up. I mean, they showed up, son. And it was awesome. No mallards, no Canada geese, but it was all these coastal. It was gadwalls, it was shovelers, it was green wings, it was blue wings, it was pintails. and scattered, you know, divers and a few redheads that showed up. And you know, the migration as it goes, think about it applies down to Mexico. You know, we do a lot of hunting down in Mexico. And those species predominate the bag of Mexico, the teal, the pintail, the widgeons, some gadwalls, and shoveler. Shoveler is the most predominant bird that I've ever seen down in Mexico in terms of just gross number. Well, a lot of those species were down there. I mean, that's what saved the season. It wasn't some of the – it may not have been quite the total possible number, but it was. They had all migrated early. They'd settled into their they fly on the calendar, not the cold front. You know, the cold front will just push the last remaining of those early migrators down, but they're not contingent on moving just strictly with the snow line, with the ice line.
Hey, Bramsey.
Hey.
You know I'm not going to let you get away from here without talking about GetDucks.com. Look, you're one of the most known personalities in the duck hunting world, one of the most knowledgeable people about ducks that I've ever hung out with, man. It's amazing what you know about ducks. But look, I've always wondered, and this is your chance to tell it to the world without having to type it up, but when and where and how did you come up with the GetDucks.com idea? Because you've already talked a little bit about a couple of your outfitters, one in Venice, one in Mexico. But how did that all come about, real quick?
You know, it came about just with the wanderlust of wanting to go somewhere. I mean, one thing I've noticed in 16 years of travel hunting like this is ducks migrate and hunters want to. We all want to move. We're duck hunters and we hunt migratory birds, and we all want to go experience another species or another environment or another area that we've heard about, you know, and it's such a fascinating world of waterfowling is. And it started with a trip. My only ambition in life really, as I got out of college and grad school and finally made just a little bit of money, was I wanted to go to Canada. And we went to Canada, and I'll tell you, we being a very close friend of mine, he was a professor at State of Mine. We've been hunting together now 24 years, and he and I booked a trip, and we went to Saskatchewan, and it was a complete unmitigated disaster. Now don't get me wrong, we shot some birds one day, but to no credit of the outfitters, it was absolutely right out the gate. The first time I ever spent money, I worked to earn hard. It was just. I could have just thrown that money out the back door and let the wind blow it off. It'd go up there and duck hunt. It was terrible. And we still wanted to go to Canada. We wanted to see what we'd heard about, read about, shoot the Canada geese at the end of your gun barrel and the mallards in the fields. And we did. And we started researching. I started doing a lot of homework, and I met an Alberta outfitter. And he later described in front of my clients, he later described the first time I ever called. We were on the phone for 2 hours, and he said I was on the ropes. I felt like, you know, it was a interview by the IRS, the FBI, and the CIA all at one time, you know, with the questions he asked. And we went up there, and it was a huge success. We had a great time. I took a few friends with me. I think myself and three others went. The following year, there were eight others, and the following year, there were nearly 20. And that third year, he asked me, you know, hey, come drink a beer with us. All the staff's out here in the shed. We're going to have a beer. Won't you have a beer? And we went out there and had a drink, and he said, Ramsey, you know, we want you to be our booking agent. And I said, what the heck's a booking agent? I'm a biologist. And he said, well, he laughed and said, look, we want you to bring some hunters up here. You've got a lot of hunters coming, you know. And you know how it is. People would call back in those days, or on Duck South. I mean, you know, we'd all sit there and chat about this stuff, and people would call and say, where do I need to go, what I need to do, and they throw in with us. And when he asked me to do that, I just, you know, stirred what I had a little bit and came up with this web page, which at the time was part habitat, part just an Alberta hunt. And from there, it was funny how it went as the internet grew. You heard a lot of stuff back in the day, as a lot of travel companies, a lot of people, a lot of travel agents booking airfare and doing just menial rote travel assignments. You know, a lot of their business took a hit. The internet killed it, they said. And I've had old time blue chip agents say the internet killed their business, and it really did not. For us, we found just the opposite, because whereas anybody with a smartphone, anybody with a computer can Google anything and find anything in this world, what we've all learned is anybody can be anything in this world. And so slowly but surely, a step at a time, we reached out and we go to the outfits. And even on our U.S. Hunt List outfit side, which is lower 48 U.S. outfitters that don't call Ramsey, call the outfitter direct. Here's the write-up, here's the description, here's the rates, here's the package, but you can call them. Just a relationship. We've been there. We've been to the lodge. We've been to the blinds. And I'm going to tell you, Rocky, you and I had this discussion. We were talking about your dove hunt, which is a great dove hunt, by the way, and very memorable, very nice feel, very good presentation, very well organized. But, you know, one thing we look at, one thing I've learned in 15 years to look at, and it kind of goes back to this weekend's blue wingtail hunting conversation, the birds don't always cooperate. And anybody's hunted, Jay Paul, anybody's ever hunted with me knows yep. I like to pull the trigger and make birds follow. I love it. But at the end of the day, when I meet with operators, what I have learned in 15 years is it's really good not to hit that opening day, not to hit that day that the duck guys laugh and just throw ducks and rain them down upon us, and everybody's a rock star. Really and truly, it's when you meet those outfitters and it's an average day. The wind isn't blowing, the sun, you know, whatever the weather's doing, the ducks are just mediocre. That's when I want to meet that outfitter, because that's when you really get to see how that outfitter shines. You know, everybody rocked on opening day. It's on an average day that a real outfitter steps up and he realizes duck hunting's what I do, but I'm in the service industry. That's what you get to see then. And that's what, as a business, we've done to where, Rocky, if you want to go to South Texas and make a referral, or you want to come to Argentina, we've removed a lot of the guesswork. We're working with people with proven, reputable outfitters. And I will say this, one more sentence. I talk for a living, guys. I mean, anybody that's ever heard of me knows I talk for a living. But one thing about it, we don't just book hunts. We don't just, hey, I know this guy, come book. That's not what we do. We have now gone in over 15 years. We're past the, hey, let me book your hunt. We don't do that anymore. We work worldwide with operators that we've gone in, we've hunted with, and say, hey, this is a great program, but you know what? For the U.S. duck hunting market, not the sports, not the five-star Hootie Twos, for the absolute hardcore duck hunter, the American duck hunter that wants to come here, this is what we feel like your program needs to be, and here's how we need to customize it. And that's a distinction. That's really kind of what we've done. And so at some point, instead of just calling Randy, let's go book a trip to Argentina or pick a spot in the world we go, you know, it's a team effort. We have gone in and customized that program, knowing after 16 years of client feedback what you as a duck hunter want to experience. And that's kind of a good duck brand.
And I can attest to that, Ramsey, because, I mean, I have talked to you when you've been getting ready to go to Pakistan. You were in the Netherlands and we talked. I've talked to you when you've been in Argentina and Paraguay. I've been on the phone with you, I think, when you were getting ready to go to Russia. I mean, so the thing about it that stuck out in my mind from the day that I met you, and I got to give a little shout out. I don't want to embarrass you, brother, but, you know, to getducks.com, for those of you that don't know it, Ramsey has a website called getducks.com. And within that, he also has a U.S. Hunt List that you just heard Ramsey mention. Now, U.S. Hunt List is a list of outfitters, guides that, and I've hunted with some of these guys, had a great hunt down there in Bastrop, Louisiana with your boy Harrison Banks.
Oh,
actually,
yeah.
It was in Arkansas, just above Bastrop, and right there on the Arkansas-Louisiana border. But the thing about these guys, the U.S. Hunt List guys, you can call them up. You can book your own hunt. You don't have to go through Ramsey as the middleman. You just find them there. But they are people that he has vetted. And so, just like you said, you know, even, I mean, it's hit and miss. It's duck hunting, not duck killing. The best places in the world have off days. It's how they respond on those off days. And so Ramsey has vetted these people, so you know what you're getting into. Also, through getducks.com, I haven't heard Ramsey say this, and it blows my mind because it's his favorite saying in the world. It's always duck season somewhere. And
oh, it is.
You know,
it's duck season somewhere, Jay Paul. And you know, it's not just calendar days, but I mean, just think about this. Every morning you get up and tie your shoes. And I think this every time I tie my shoes, where's it duck season today? Because every single day of the year, it's duck season somewhere. And what we're seeing is, I'm not about to get into a big political talking forum about hunting, but it is changing times. There are places closing to hunting. It's changing right under our feet. But at the same time, there's new venues opening up this coming year. And we can only do this in fits and starts. I mean, you know, you just can't climb. You got to kind of level out and take your breath every now and again, financially and time-wise. But back in 2012 and 13, we really grew a lot. Mexico and Argentina that's our bread and butter. That is our absolute top of the line. That's what we specialize in. It's where we started. It's what we're still great at. And I feel like we've got the very best waterfowl hunting opportunities in either country, hands down. We sell out a lot of lodges down there now.
You know, we said, I don't want you to turn everything out of the bag either, because, guys, we're going to have Ramsey back on here. Ramsey has got a whole bunch of places that we just do not think about as destinations under that it's always duck season somewhere theme. And Ramsey, I don't want you to tell them about everything. I want you to hold a little bit of it back
for
the next time we have you on here, because some of the places that you were telling me about earlier just absolutely blew my mind. And I think we can make, let's just leave this as a little teaser right here and now.
Sure.
We're going to have you back here after you complete this trip, giving us a report on how this did go and kind of a overview of what you're going to be writing about. And then we want all of our guys to be able to hear about some opportunities that fall well outside of the Mississippi Delta. And Ramsey, before we shut her down right here, I got to tell you, you're new. This is your first time as our guest. It's been great to have you. Every week we have closing thoughts. We haven't had Houston with us for the last couple of podcasts. So today I'm going to start with our resident fat boy, Houston Kennedy. Brother, what you got for Ramsey here?
All right, Ramsey. So all the fat boys want to know, what kind of snacks do you keep in your blind bag?
I don't. I'm one of those people. I do not travel with food and drink. I refuse to. I go hungry till I get. When I get back to camp, I eat. And I do not travel with a can of Copenhagen be the closest thing to a snack I keep in my pocket.
All right, Ramsey, since you don't carry a snack in the field, what's your favorite duck recipe at camp, or what's your favorite food when you get back to camp where the kitchen is?
Duck breast. I got a special recipe that I cook duck breast with, and I cook it all over the world that they'll let me back in the kitchen.
I want to hear about that. And Josh, we're fixing to bring you in, brother. I tell you what, I got a great idea. Josh, what do you think about maybe you getting with Ramsey and getting us that recipe for the DuckSouth.com website?
Yeah, I think that'd be cool. I was thinking about that, Jay Paul and Ramsey, and I know that Ramsey probably has variations of it as he goes to all these countries, so maybe we'll have a little, the American side to the recipe and some of these overseas destinations and the ingredients he gets to use to cook his recipe worldwide. I think that'd be pretty cool. Get that up on the site here quick. Ramsey, I do want to I'm gonna take this as my final thought. I have followed all the social media and stuff for getducks.com for a long time now, and there is another term that tends to follow you around that I think needs to be defined for the public, and that would be the Ramzilla. Would you like to touch on that?
Man, it follows me everywhere, and I embrace it wholeheartedly. I started earlier by saying my favorite duck is the next duck over the decoys. And years ago, while hunting with a good friend of mine, Mr. Pat Pitt, up at Langill Lounge, Arkansas.
Yep, I know Pat.
They put away good quality ducks, mallards, and pintails, and then sometimes things get tough. Well, you know, I was raising two kids, two young boys. And one thing I can tell you about raising young men, young people, kids, they got to touch things. They only love what they touch. And you know, it's very hard to make a young man, 8, 9, 10 years old, stand down on just shooting a duck. Let them shoot a duck. And you know what? My old dog at the time, my dog now, they don't know the difference. They fetch ducks, and that's what you're there for, right? And we would shoot shovels. And a lot of camp would not. A lot of those members would not shoot shovels. And me and the boys would, and we did. And one of the camp members up there one day just coined the term Ramzilla. And everywhere we've gone, it has just kind of followed it. You know, but I embrace it. It's a shoveler. And you want to talk about getting folks talking, is post up a picture of a shoveler on Facebook.
Yeah, no kidding.
And it will hit all the, you know, but let me say this, as somebody that does work with hunters all over the world, cinnamon tail, I'd say number one, that's the number one most requested species, it would be a cinnamon tail. But in terms of the guys that go somewhere in North America, down south, or down to Mexico, and come back with a few birds for their wall.
I know where you're going.
A northern shoveler is predominates. If they're not in the deep south, I mean Texas, Mississippi, Louisiana, and I'm gonna say them three states. If they're not from those three states, and we probably already got one. If they're from somewhere else up north, especially when you start getting the northern latitudes, they've never seen a shoveler like we take for granted down here. And that's a very beautiful bird.
There definitely is an exception to that, because I know one Mississippian that absolutely loves the northern shoveler. Our own Rocky LaFleur. Rocky Amarover, is that your favorite duck skill of all? I've been with you since Golden Wild, Mississippi.
I've got to go take a nerve pill. Y'all got me shaking talking about these shovelers.
Amen, brother. Well, while I got you talking about it.
Dude, hey, Ramsey, my appreciation for you just went a lot higher, brother.
Oh.
Because there is no
man,
other duck like a shoveler.
I love all those ducks. I love them all. You got to shoot. You got to have odd ducks anyway in a on the best of days, you get to shoot 4 milers in Mississippi. What are you going to shoot for your odd ducks, huh? You know, and they're a pretty duck. They're a nice duck. And you know, it just is what it is. My dog doesn't care. My kids didn't care. And now they've gotten older, and they've gotten a little sensitive. I got to tell you this story. I've known Mr. Mike Morgan, who's a producer down there with Mojo. I've known him since I was 19 years old. That's a long time. And one time he and I went to go film a show, and it was good. We shot some mallards. We went to old J.J. Kent. I know you've hung with him, Jay Paul.
Oh, yeah.
And
yes,
we had a great hunt. And we shot in the field. We shot on the river. We killed mallards. We killed pintail. We shot some green wings. And one evening he come in there and said, man, I've got a pond just loaded with ducks, but now it's a bunch of shovelers. And Mike and I said, yeah, sure, man, that's fine. And we went, and I think there were 5 or 6 of us in the blind. We may have accidentally shot a green wing or something else, but it was an absolute shoveler beatdown. And they named that episode Spoon and Crockett, and the comment I made in the blind. And Mr. Terry Demon said, well, that settles that. I'm not ever leaving you two alone without adult supervision again. We're so proud of it. You know, it's a great. But you know, it was one of the shows I've been a part of that received the most public sentiment. I mean, they got so much calls because, come on, man, regular duck hunters, we shoot ducks. You know, there are parts of this country that, you know, you're gonna be lucky to shoot anything other than a mallard. I've been to Washington State, I've been to parts of the Midwest, and mallard are mm-hmm. king. But you struggle to shoot anything outside of that.
Yeah, you know, for some people going out and being able to do that is a treat. I know I did an episode a few years ago, and Rocky's been to this spot there next to Antelope Island on the Great Salt Lake, where there were thousands and thousands of shovelers. And, you know, the guys there, they could shoot mallards all the time. But when those shovelers come through, that's something special, and they go after them. But the one thing that I can say very, very proudly about both our guest today and about our co-host, Rocky LaFleur, is neither one of you guys are duck bigots, that's for sure. Listen, guys, we're just about out of time here.
Jay Fall, bring this conversation full circle. We're talking about blue wing till to start. And, you know, the way the biologist really sets an idea bird foolproof is by the wing. You know, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service post-season every year samples hunters. This year I was selected to submit all the wings of the ducks I shot in the United States. And they'll survey them, and based just on the wings, they will age and sex that bird. And I've done that. I can look at a wing and tell you all that stuff. But I'll tell you this, I guarantee you, if I took a blue wing teal, especially an adult male, if I took just his wing and laid it side by side with a Drake shoveler, I would wager a bet that 8 out of 10 or 9 out of 10 hunters could not accurately distinguish between the two. They're that closely. I mean, so something tells me that way back in the wood pile, they're cousins. You know what I'm saying?
I would agree, brother. Yeah, definitely. Man, it is amazing. I tell you, it's been wonderful having you, Ramsey, because the amount of knowledge that you have just blows me away. I mean, look at it. Today from the podcast, you know, for future articles for DuckSouth.com, we've got an article on comparing the wing from a Drake blue wing and a Drake shoveler. We've got an article potentially about shooting shovelers in different places, like down there in Louisiana. You were talking about out on the Great Salt Lake. I know we're going to hear about it on fish ponds from Rocky. We've learned about the migration of the blue-winged teal, and we're about to come away with a super recipe on DuckSouth.com that Josh is fixing to write up. And I can't imagine if we had you for another hour and a half. God only knows what we'll come up with next time. But that's all the time we've got for this week. Man, Ramsey, thank you so much for being with us. I can't wait to have you back. Rocky, Josh, Houston, as always, it's been a pleasure this week. Glad to have the full gang with us, coming from the Duck South Studios in Morgan City, Mississippi. This has been the Advantage Multi on the X Podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.